Okay, so let's start with a general announcement. The project was due today. You are allowed to take an extension day. There are a finite, limited number of extension days that you can take. I forgot the number. I think it's 2 in total. If you decide to do this, you have time until the following day at 11:59 p.m. So you have the entire evening, following evening, to for your extension day. But I, you don't have to take an extension day. You can turn it in on time. How many people have turned it in already? How many people need an extension day, or you don't want to show up your hands? So most people turn it on. Any issues with the project? Did you hate it? Did you like it? Did you learn? Did you? Yes.
Well, I think I learned more about C# than database.
You learn more about C# than about databases. How many hours did you spend on this phase of the project?
20 for two people.
10.
About 10 per person. 10, 11. That's what I was expecting. I think 10 around 10 hours per phase is what I normally expect. If you can do it faster, please do it faster. If you need more time, then it's not good. It means that we need to redesign that phase. Okay. The second homework has been posted, and you're free to start working on it. There is a little bit of programming that you have to do. There is a story with Mr. Frumble there. When I designed these homeworks the first time, my kids were I have twins, and they were 4 years old. And there are these beautiful books about Mr. Frumble, and he gets himself into trouble. How many people know the Mr. Frumble books? Not too many. Well, anyway, if you don't know who Mr. Frumble is, it doesn't quite matter. He's a character for kids. And he got himself into trouble because he got his data, and he doesn't know what to do with it. So what you have to do to this data, you have to normalize it. According to the theory that we started to discuss last time, and that I'm planning to review right now. The catch is that unlike the standard textbook problems that give you the functional dependencies and then you have to apply normalization theory, in this problem there are no functional dependencies. You just get the data. So you have to discover the functional dependencies. How? Using SQL queries. So you have to be creative to figure out what SQL queries can you ask in order to discover the functional dependencies. Now, this doesn't have a unique solution, although I think there is a canonical one. But here is a non-solution. You can ask the identity query, select star from table, and you get back an answer from which you can look up and figure out the functional dependency. Right, you get back all these 1,000 rows, and the functional dependencies are just there. This is not the solution we are looking for. We are looking for a solution in which the query really helps you, in which it returns a small set of answers, like a single row, or something very small that tells you yes or no, this functional dependency holds. There is no way you can write one single query that tells you all the functional dependencies. You have to probe. For every candidate functional dependency, you have to write another SQL query and then try again. You end up writing 8 or 10 queries this way until you figure it out. It's a fun problem. And I don't think there are any other issues with the homework as far as I'm aware. The next phase of the project will be posted as soon as Inga starts to work on it, probably on Wednesday, probably on Thursday. Okay, today I'm planning to finish our discussion on the Boyce Code Normal Form, which we started last week. I think this is subtle, and I really would like to discuss it with you in class. And then I have what I think is a very fun lecture on constraints. This I didn't expand too much, but then on views. Views are extremely versatile in database and data management in general, and they are not well covered in textbooks. They're kind of like common knowledge of among researchers, and I'm going to try to convey that common knowledge to you. But before that, we need to do the boring part, which is normalization. So let me ask you, why do we worry about normalizing a table? In practice, why do we want to normalize? Yes?
Duplication, so we don't waste space.
So we don't waste space. There is a CRISPR term for this. To eliminate anomalies. To eliminate anomalies. And now the next question is, what kind of anomalies are there? There are three, and there are kind of different names of the same thing. Yes?
There's duplication, and there's the update anomaly.
There is the update anomaly.
And the duplication anomaly.
Yeah, duplication anomaly, which I think is called the redundancy anomaly. And the last one is the deletion anomaly. These are the screen named anomalies. As somebody pointed out last time, they are essentially different ways to look at the same thing. So how do we detect anomalies? What is a theoretical tool to detect anomalies? We need to learn what? Functional dependencies. Very formal thing. We write functional dependencies like this. An attribute determines a set of attributes, determines an attribute or a set of attributes. And we know what this means. They hold on a table if for any two tuples that agree on the left part of the functional dependency, they also agree on the right part of the functional dependency. So this slide that we're looking at right now, this tells us exactly how to use functional dependencies to detect anomalies. Namely, whenever we find a functional dependency, we check if the left-hand side is a key. If it's a key or a super key, then it's okay. If it's not a super key, then it's not okay. Then we need to do something. We need to normalize. So, for example, in our example from last time, the functional dependency that we identified was a social security number determines name and city, but it does not determine which attribute does social security number not determine. The phone number. This functional dependency is a violation. It points to an anomaly because social security number is not a key. It's not a super key. Which brings me to the question, what is a key? It's actually a set of attributes. That has what property? That uniquely identifies the other attributes. But this definition looks at the table. If we just look at the functional dependencies, how would we rephrase this property? The closure of this set of attributes is what? It's all the attributes. Exactly. Or, in other words, this set of attributes functionally determines all the other attributes. In SQL, when you create a table in SQL, how many keys can you create? Just one, and it's called primary key, because there is just one. Don't be confused by the fact that it may consist of multiple attributes. Just one single key. Now, in theory, does this match with the theory? Can we have an abstract table, meaning a set of attributes and a set of functional dependencies, where there are two keys? And we forgot to mention, a key is a minimal set of attributes that determines all the others. Can we have two different keys?
Sure, yeah.
Yep. Let's give an example with three attributes, ABC.
You'd have one with someone's name, their social security number, and their customer ID.
Okay, let's call them A, B, and C. Name, social security number, and customer ID. But now we need to write down the functional dependencies.
A is 1, 2, 3. B is 4, 5, 6. C is 7, 9. then all of them should be keys.
So I think you think about the data. I would like to think about what functional dependencies to write. So examples of functional dependencies I can write are like this. Suppose I write just this. A determines B and A determines C. Do we have two keys now?
We only have one.
A and B, C.
What are the keys?
A.
At Microsoft?
A.
Just A, because A plus is indeed A, B, C. And we can create larger sets, but they are no longer keys, they are super keys. And B plus, what is B plus here?
B.
Just B, so this is not a key. So here we have a single key, just A. I really want an example where we have two keys.
Yes. A derives B and C, and C derives A and B.
A determines B and C, and then C determines
A and B.
A and B. So, what are the keys in this case?
A and C.
A plus is A, B, C, so this is a key, and C plus is A, B, C, also a key. Perfect, that's a good example. Another example I think would be this. A implies B, B implies C, and C implies A. How many keys do we have now?
Three.
Three keys. Every single set of attributes is a key. Good. So here are some similar. Yeah, we actually worked out both examples. Okay, so now let's review the definition of the Boyce code normal form. We saw what kind of functional dependencies correspond to anomalies. A table is in Boyce code normal form if it does not have those kinds of functional dependencies. More precisely, if a table R, a relation R, is said to be in Boyce code normal form, if for any functional dependency, either this functional dependency is trivial, or the left-hand side is a super key. What does a trivial functional dependency mean?
B is a subset of A1 to An.
B is a subset of A1 to An, exactly. So let's, equivalently, and this is important because the algorithm we are going to use is based on this observation. It means that for any set X, either its closure is a set of all attributes, and in this case, what is X?
Super key.
In this case, it's a super key. Or X plus is X, which means that if X determines something, that's just a trivial functional dependency. So this is an alternative formulation of the Boyce code normal form. If the table is like this, then it's fine. But if it's not like this, then here is what we need to do. We take any violation, any functional dependency that violates the Boyce code normal form definition, and we decompose the table into two tables, one consisting of the A's and the B's, and the other consisting of the A's and the other attributes. Let's see this in action on our example. So here SSN implies name and city is a violation of the Boyce code normal form. So SSN will be the A's, name and city will be the B's, and what is C? What are the others?
Phone
number. So according to the strict theory, how should we decompose this table? Into SSN, let me write here, into SSN name and city, and SSN and phone number. So if we do this, then the table looks like that. SSN name and city, and SSN and phone number. Interestingly, in the first table, what is SSN now? Now it's a key. And it's by necessity so, because we included SSN with all the attributes that it implies. So this is a general property. Whenever we decompose in order to normalize in Boyce called normal form, in one of the tables, the A's will form a key. Okay, so I wanted to do this example in class. But actually, I don't want to do it now. I want to do it using our algorithm. Here is the algorithm that I would like to use, that we should use. Instead of blindly searching through functional dependencies, we will use the closures of set X. So we will do this. We will find a set X that violates the Boyce called normal form. It means that its closure is neither X, so it's bigger than X, but it's not big enough to include all the attributes. So then we will use this set X as the A's. The new attribute in X plus, so this is, maybe I should draw here, X are the A's. Now when we compute this closure, we will get some extra stuff. This is X plus.
You can see it here in my computer.
Can you see now?
No.
Oh, there is a... Can you see... You can't see anything?
We can see the slides, but not the markup, and he's working on it to see if he can fix it.
Okay.
That's the question we're waiting.
Yes, a question.
In order to be a super key, you don't have to have all the attributes, right? Or do you?
In order to be a super key, a set of attributes is a super key when?
It contains a key.
When it contains a key, or alternatively, when it's closure, is exactly the set of all attributes. It can't be bigger, all right? That's the definition. A super key is when its closure is a set of all attributes. Then what's a key? It's a super key for which you can't eliminate any attribute and still be a super key.
Can you test the slide? Try writing on the slide.
Okay. Let me write here.
Yep. Okay. Yep.
Okay. Good. So let's examine in detail this algorithm, because that's the one that I would like you to remember and to use as a homework, and just to remember for future, as he did Boyce called normal form decomposition. It's actually simpler than that given in many textbooks. So we pick a set X, and I don't have any good recommendation of which one to pick. It's a matter of intuition. Pick a set X of attributes that violates the Boyce called normal form, which means that its closure is not too big and not too small. Its closure is a little bit bigger than X, but does not contain all the attributes. This set X now will form the A's. The extra attributes that are in its closure but not in X, these are the B's. And what are the C's? Of course, the rest. Those that were not included in X plus, and we know there are other attributes remaining. So now it's obvious. We will decompose the table into two tables consisting of which attributes? R1 consists of A and B, and R2 consists of A and C. This is what's written on the slides, but using X and Y and C. Now, in one of these tables, we know a key. In which table? R1. In R1, what is the key?
A.
A. And why is that? Because A implies B, right? A is just X, and X plus is X plus is exactly A union B. Any questions about the Boyce-Codd normal form algorithm? Okay, so now we can see it in action, and now we can examine this example. So here we have two functional dependencies. Social security number determines name and age, and age determines hair color. Right? It's when you look at the age, and you know exactly if he has a grayish hair or not. That's the intuition. So how do we do a Boyce-Codd normal form here? We have to pick this set of attributes X in some way. In the first iteration, I pick here X to be SSN. So X is just SSN. We compute SSN plus, and we know how to compute the closure. We start with SSN, we include name because of the first functional dependency, and also age, and once we have age, then we also have hair color. Is this a violation of the Boyce-Codd normal form?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bigger than X. However, it's not a set of all attributes. Which one is missing? The phone number. So then we decompose this into two tables. One is one consists of SSN name, age, and hair color, and the other consists of SSN and the phone number. But here is a point. After one step of the decomposition, we are not done. We need to continue. We need to examine each of these two tables and see if they are in Boyce-Codd normal form. What about the second one? Is the second table in Boyce-Codd normal form? Yes, it is. And actually, I'd like to go back to this in a minute. But for now, let's examine the first table. So that's the purpose of the second iteration, to decompose P. So here, what happens if we start with a set SSN? We pick SSN again. Is this set a violation of the Boyce-Codd normal form?
No.
No, why not? Because in this table, X plus, X is a key. X plus is a set of all attributes. So this is not a good choice. Let's pick age. H plus points to a violation of the Boyce-Codd normal form. And this is closer as hair color, but doesn't include SSN. So bingo. Now we can decompose it into SSN and name and age and age hair color. And this is the final decomposition. And if you look at the attributes, they actually mean something. These tables mean something. And I actually gave them names. The first one contains SSN's names and age. Clearly, this is data about people. I shouldn't have given the name. The second one, of course, is a funny one. This represents our domain knowledge, meaning that in this particular domain, the age determines the hair color. And the third one is stores the phone numbers. And here there is no key, because we allow multiple people, we allow the same person to have multiple phone numbers. Is this example clear? Good.
So in the last table, essentially the SSN and phone number together form a key.
Correctly. In the last table, these two form a key. Okay, now let me ask you this. Can you give me an example of a table with two attributes that is not in Boyce-Codd normal form? I'm going to call it R with A and B. What functional dependencies would be designed to make this R not in Boyce code normal form? It's not possible. Why not? How many attributes do we need to have a violation of the Boyce code normal form? We need three attributes, the A's, the B's, and the C's. If any of them is empty, then the table is automatically in Boyce code normal form. Okay, a simple illustration. When we do this decomposition, it helps to think in terms of a tree. At the top, we start with the entire table. And after the first step, we decompose into two tables. And then we continue. We decompose each of them in additional tables until the tables that we end up with are in Boyce code normal form. It's a very simple idea.
Can I ask a question about that?
Yes, a question.
Well, I went through the slides, and you have questions on what happens if you choose something else. And of course, you end up with a different final form.
Mm-hmm. Right. This is actually a good question. I should have. It's good. Thank you for pointing this out. So, what happens if we start the decomposition here with a different initial set X? So in this example, it turns out we end up with a different normal form. Any of them is okay. There is no good initial choice. You may end up with different normal forms, and they are all okay. There are different ways to decompose the same table given those functional dependencies. Now, in a real application, of course, I would advise you to use these function dependencies less rigidly, to use to also rely on your intuition. And this is because often it's difficult to collect the exact function dependencies that must hold in an application. And sometimes they're a moving target. They may hold today, but they may not hold tomorrow. So relying on the intuition is an important complement to the theory of function dependencies. Any more questions about this slide?
Question about
yes.
So once you decompose into R1 and R2, then you're looking at B plus under the set R1.
Yes.
Why is it you're looking at B plus instead of looking at A plus again?
Right. So why the question is, why do I look here at B plus instead of A plus?
Because you've already looked at A plus, so you don't
want to
repeat that?
Yeah, so let's dig a little bit deeper here. What happens if here we examine the set X A again, as we did here? What will we discover?
X plus is all attributes.
So in this case, X plus is a set of all attributes. Is this by accident?
No,
it's always the case that on the left, if you pick A again, it's a set of all attributes. Does it make sense? Does this answer your question?
What if there was a third dependency relationship, though? Is the one that you choose arbitrary, or do you have to go in a certain order? Like if you had a D and an E in there?
My point is it doesn't matter what we have. Once we have ensured here that, so what do we pick on the left? On the left, essentially, R1 consists of X plus. The attributes that we keep in R1 are exactly X plus. And those in R2 are exactly all minus, it's difficult to minus X plus, but union X. So if in R1, we pick X again, what is its closure? It's the set of all attributes. My point is that this is not an accident. It's always a case that in one of the two tables, in the left table, if you pick X again, the same as we use for the first decomposition, that is a key. Yes, a question there.
Similarly, if we pick X again on the right, shouldn't we always get just X? As its closure?
Exactly. So what happens if we pick X on the right? What is the closure here? He said it. It's exactly X. So by necessity, if we pick X again, either in R1 or in R2, we don't make any more progress. X is fine now. We better look for a different set of attributes. So we are making progress. We can't fix the same set twice and achieve two decomposition steps with the same set. Okay. So,
Professor.
Yes.
In the worst case, isn't this algorithm exponential?
So the question is, what is the complexity of the decomposition? This algorithm is exponential for many reasons. Just computing the keys might be exponential. If you, I don't know that this theory of functional dependencies, it's not very modern. It's considered an archaic theory and database theory. But I know that computing the keys is something like NP complete. That's what the book states, and this makes sense. If you think of having N keys, N attributes, and your candidate keys are all subsets of size n by 2, then you have exponentially many candidates to look for. So to answer your question, this algorithm is exponential, and there is no better way we can't improve it. On the other hand, do we really care? Is this exponential in the size of what?
Columns, number of columns.
In the number of columns. What's the typical number of columns?
10.
10 is actually for the homework. what is the typical number in practice? People here know better than I do.
Depends on what it's for.
Yeah, but you don't like very wide tables.
You don't like very wide tables, but I do hear about tables that have dozens, even hundreds of attributes. So it can be towards big. Even in that case, I think if you design your algorithm well and look for sets X that are small, start from the small ones and then increase, your keys are probably not made of huge sets of attributes. So I think you can heuristically tweak this algorithm to run with reasonable performance on realistic tables. There is an upper bound on the number of attributes. I know this from Oracle. I'm not completely sure about my SQL Server. What's the upper bound?
Well, has it fit in one page? Like the size has to fit on the page.
The size of a record should fit on one page, yes. What do you know?
Depends on the version of SQL Server.
Oh, it depends on the version of SQL Server. Oracle had an upper bound of about 1024, I think, when I needed this. I didn't need to know this about 6 or 7 years ago. So the size of the schema can be reasonably large. Don't expect tables with 10 attributes in real life. They can have 50 attributes or 200 attributes. It's never going to be 10,000. That's where you should think about schemas. Okay. Now, a thought about decomposition. If I give you any table, and let me actually move to the example here. If I give you a table, like this one, it's a table about products, and I decide, for whatever reason, to decompose it into two tables, and they share a common attribute, or they share a set of common attributes. In this case, I decide to decompose this into two tables that share the name, but price is only in one, and category is only in the other one. My question is, can I always do this? Can I always take a table and decompose it into two tables? To be precise, the question is, once we decompose, can we reconstruct the original table from the two smaller tables? Can we reconstruct the original table in this example? What operation will take these two tables, call them R1 and R2, and compute R?
Join on name.
The join on name. And this is written like this. Does everyone understand this notation, what it means? So that's the way we attempt to reconstruct R from R1 and R2. In this particular example, if we compute a join, do we recover R? Yeah. For example, after doing the join, this tuple will join with this tuple. Oh, and also with this tuple, I'm sorry. And this tuple will join with that tuple. So how many tuples do we get in the join? Exactly three, which are exactly the tuples in R. By the way, actually, how did we get R1 and R2 from R? How did we get R1 from R with using what operation?
Well, it's a projection with distinct, perhaps.
It's a projection with distinct, exactly. It's a projection followed by the, which in SQL we just write select distinct name price from R. In the relational algebra, which we haven't studied yet, but it's easy to discuss, this is written as pi, and now we really need to list the attributes, otherwise it's ambiguous. We project on name and price on R. And R2 is a projection on name and category on R. So the former problem is the following. Is it the case that for any table R, if we compute R1 and R2 according to these projections, and then reconstruct R according to that formula, do we get R back?
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily in general, of course. We can have counterexamples. For example, here. Here we decided to keep category as a common attribute. And I computed R1 and R2 using the same projections. And now if we reconstruct R, what happens? Do we get fewer tuples than we need, or do we get more tuples than we need, or both?
More.
We get more. Every tuple in R, we will recover. For example, this one, one click and camera goes is projected here in R1, and is projected here in R2, and once when we do the join, we will recover it. But we get too many tuples. Which one in particular? These two cameras, they join with these two cameras, and one of them is wrong. This one is wrong.
2499
gizmo. Okay. 2499 gizmo. There are only two cameras, and we will get four once we do the join. So something will be wrong. Yes.
But we wouldn't have gotten this decomposition via our algorithm, right?
Our algorithm will look at functional dependencies.
Because there is no functional dependency between category and either name or price.
Exactly. So his observation was that our decomposition algorithm will never do this. Will never do this because it looks at the functional dependencies. So here is an interesting insight. This decomposition of R into R1 and R2 is always lossless if the A's, the common attributes, functionally determine either the B's or the C's. What's interesting is that in some sense it's an if and only if statement. If they don't functionally determine, then it's a lossy decomposition. And this is exactly what the BCNF algorithm does. It only applies a decomposition in such cases. Okay, so that is the end of the Boyce-Codd normal form decomposition. Now, in practice, you will hear quite often about a different normal form called the third normal form. It's described in the book, not very well, is described in much worse in the other textbook. It's a complicated theory to do the third normal form, and since in practice you need to complement the theory with a lot of intuition, it's not worthwhile to really understand the details, but I think it is instructive to understand the issue it's addressing. So let me show you in the last few slides what the third normal form is supposed to solve without actually showing you how to decompose in the third normal form. So here is what is here is the problem. Sometimes when we after we decompose, the nth tables that we get are no longer able to capture all the functional dependencies that we started with. In this example, we start with a top table in which we have this is where I would like you to look at, and now let me read. So we have unit and company and product. The first functional dependency says that every unit belongs to a company. The second functional dependency says something weird, that every product is made in each company by at most one unit. Read it this way. The same product may be made by many companies. But inside the company, the same product will only be made by a single unit, by the unit that makes that type of product. This is what the second functional dependency says. So, let's forget about the third normal form. Let's think about the Boyce-Codd normal form. Let's try to see if this schema is in BCNF. Is it? It's not, because look, we start with unit, we compute its closure, and unit only implies company but does not imply products. So it's a very simple decomposition in which we split the table into unit and company, our R1, and unit and product, our R2. And that is a Boyce-Codd normal form. But now, let's examine what functional dependencies we have on these two tables. Well, there is this functional dependency on the left, and there is nothing on the right. So, which functional dependency did we lose? The second one. Nobody tells us anymore that each product must be made in a single unit of each company. So, this is why the entire theory of the third normal form exists. What does it tell us? Well, essentially, it tells us that the original table was okay. That's the bottom line. And the definition is, and I don't think I should read it. So please read this at home. It's a small change of the Boyce-Codd normal form. It allows such a functional dependency to exist, provided that B is part of a key. And it's very mysterious why. But then the theory can be developed. Going back, this functional dependency now may exist. We're happy with it because unit is part of a key. Look, it's part of which key? It's part of this key. Of the key unit, comma, product. Unit and product together form a key. And unit is part of this key. So it's easy to understand the definition. So you can read this, and it's easy to recognize which tables are in the third normal form.
But isn't it just the opposite of what you said? It's saying A is implying B. So in our example, unit was implying company, and company is part of a key.
Oh, no, you look at this functional dependency here.
It's saying unit implying company is okay.
No, it's saying that this functional dependency is okay.
That one isn't BCNF though.
So this functional dependency is not okay for
but
BCNF.
It already is okay for BCNF, like he's saying. That functional dependency is already not a problem. The problem is unit implying company.
Oh, you're right. What am I saying? Yeah, you're right. So, let me exercise the erase feature. Thank you. Very good. So this is the functional dependency that violated the Boyce code normal form. Unit is not a key. Unit plus is just unit on company. So this is what we use to do the decomposition. Very good observation. So now comes in the third normal form and says, wait a minute, this functional dependency is okay because company is part of a key. Of which key? Of the company product key. This is the key. Because this closure contains unit and this key. So the intuition is, it says, don't split based on this functional dependency, because then company wants to be part of a key, and then we split that key, and then we're in trouble. This is what it says. Okay. So how should we think about the third normal form? So the point is that the book explains correctly how to decompose in a normal form, but it's not it's a difficult read. And in general, I don't find it an algorithm. But there is a good way to think about this. With the Boyce code normal form, we decompose in that tree going down until we reach very small tables that are that eliminate all possible anomalies. But by decomposing so far, we may have cut across some keys, and then we do some functional dependencies. In the third normal form, think about this as going less deep in the tree, stopping earlier. And that means that there will be some anomalies, like in that table, that we have to keep as is. So we will live with some anomalies, but the advantage is that we store all functional dependencies. That's a way to think about it. But now actually, let's go back and be real about this. Let me go back here. If I erase all the comments I made, and if I ask you, if you didn't take this class, and I ask you which of these you understand the functional dependency, so they are with us. But out of these two schemas, R and R1, R2, which schema would you recommend for usage? Which schema would you use? Would you use the unit company product schema or the two tables, the decomposed schema?
First
which one?
R.
I don't hear you, Bell.
The first one.
The first one, the top one. I would use the second one because it eliminates the anomalies. I would stick with this functional dependency and say, look, every unit belongs to a company, so why not store it here? What do we lose if we use the Boyce code normal form decomposition? We lose one functional dependency. How bad can this be in practice? Can we compensate? Of course.
Constraint.
Sorry?
Add
a constraint, and then we are still using theory, or just do it in the application. Right? So what can be wrong? Maybe there is some application that wants to insert a product made by a company in some unit, and that product is already made by the same company in a different unit. you just check for this condition in the application, and this way you enforce the functional dependency yourself.
But in practice, they usually tell you all the functional, or they tell you many of the functional dependencies, and you would form, and so I think in practice you'd still pick R, because you're usually not decomposing, you're going from the functional dependencies that they give you, and you're constructing tables from them.
So you're saying that in your experience, you do get the functional dependencies.
Yeah, so like if I were to design a database, the customer would say, you know, there can only be one product coming from a company unit.
Right.
And so then I would design one table to do that.
Okay. I fully buy your argument. So there is a disagreement, okay? You can go both ways.
Question?
Yes.
Is there any danger in over-normalizing?
Danger of over-normalizing. I think the distinction between Boyce Core normal form and third normal form captures precisely this danger. If you normalize all the way to Boyce Core normal form, then you in some sense over-normalize because you are losing some functional dependencies. It's a formal way to capture this danger. Otherwise, I'm not aware of danger of normalizing. Since we normalize, however, no, let me actually look rephrase this differently. Yes.
You could lose performance by normalizing.
You couldn't lose performance by normalizing. Sometimes we denormalize in order to regain performance. Let me make a statement. Joins are crucial to database systems. We live and die on joins. Why? What is the best explanation why joins are so critical? We never hear about joins in C# or in Java or in XML for that reason.
You can't have nested.
But in databases, joins are crucial. Why? There is a deep reason why joins are crucial.
The tables have to be flat.
They have to be flat. They can't be nested. That's right, but that's not the only reason. We do lots of joins in databases. 3, 4, 6 way joins all the time. Why? Because of what's on the screen. Because the tables are normalized. You start with a white table, but then you split it into these small tables, and then you have to reconstruct it. Joins are critical to relational databases because relational databases need to be normalized. And then to recover the data, we need to do the joins. These two go hand in hand. This is why there is so much emphasis on handling joins efficiently, because the data has to be normalized. And the converse holds. And data models that are not normalized, like XML, which that can be nested, or object-oriented data models that were pushed heavily 15 years ago and they didn't quite replace relational databases. So the story there was maybe we don't need so many joins because now it's not normalized. But it turns out that for efficiency purposes, it's still better to normalize and then to apply joins. Yes, there was a question here.
So we're talking a lot about normalizing. Are you going to touch on data mining where you don't want to normalize?
Not really. I'm going to talk a little bit about views in the next hour, in about 2 hours or less. And then we'll discuss a little bit non-normal data. Data mining, if we have time, maybe during the last lecture. I think what we have in mind, though, is more data warehousing than data mining.
Question?
Yes.
Couldn't you achieve the same thing via constraints that you're achieving through normalization? Is it just a physical way of opposing those constraints?
Can you repeat this, please?
Could you achieve via constraints the same thing that you're achieving via normalization?
Can you achieve via constraints the same thing as through normalization? I don't see how. Oh, yeah, I think I understand. You want to avoid anomalies through constraints.
Yeah.
To some extent, you can. Yes, to some extent you can achieve that. It's a trade-off, but then you're regaining efficiency by denormalizing, and you're losing some efficiency because now you have constraints. Okay, and talking about constraints, let's move to today's lecture, So let's move to today's lecture. Ah, I think I know what I have to do. When we will talk about constraints and views in this order. And if you looked at the outline that we had originally, we are not going to talk about security in this lecture. I think views require an extensive discussion, and I prefer to have that discussion today rather than scatter it throughout this course. But we'll start with constraints. And here is an outline of the chapters. We will discuss constraints, the triggers, very little. Actually, the triggers are handled a little bit better in the other textbook. And then the discussion on views is not captured in any of these textbooks. There are some papers that I can recommend to you, but essentially you have to rely on the slides. So constraints. What is a constraint? A constraint is a property that the state must hold over the data, over the database, for the entire life of the database. It's essential for ensuring that the data is clean, that nothing goes wrong with it. Now, the system is responsible for enforcing the constraints that we have declared during updates. So whenever a tuple is inserted or deleted or updated, the system has to check the constraints. Does it remind you of something in programming languages? If you studied formal programming languages or data structures, the constraints correspond to what?
Preconditions, postconditions.
Preconditions, postconditions, or invariants. That's exactly what they are. But there is an important difference. In data structures, when you define the invariant of some data structure, you prove it. You prove that one holds. In databases, we don't prove it. We actually check it. We check it every time we update it. Because the data is of such a value for us, we are willing to pay the price of making this extra check. So what kind of constraints do we have in SQL? Four types that we are going to discuss, going from the simplest one to the most complex ones. Let me start directly with key constraints. And everyone by now should know keys in SQL. You have implemented them in your project. So this is how we define them. There are two ways, either next to an attribute or at the end of the table, separately. Which one is more general? One of them can express keys that the other syntax cannot express. Yes. This one is more powerful. Why is that?
Specify more than one field.
We can define keys that consist of more than one attribute. Like here. Here, this key consists of name and category together. Okay, we know what it means. It means that, what does the system need to do once we have defined a key? What does it need to watch for? Yes?
An index on those attributes and make sure that there are no duplicates.
So create an index and make sure that there are no duplicates. But I wanted to phrase a question as follows. There are three kinds of data modifications that we can write in SQL. They were on the first lecture, and we did not discuss them explicitly in class. How can you modify data in SQL?
Insert,
update, and delete. Insert, update, and delete records. For each of them, let's discuss what the system needs to do in order to enforce a constraint. That's a constraint. Sorry?
Cell phone.
So in the case of a key constraint, what does the system need to do during an insert? Make sure that the name and category of that new tuple is not present in the database. What does it need to do during an update?
Make sure there is one.
During an update? Oh, yeah, well, it depends. When we say an update, do we have to specify a key?
No.
No, you can say update all products with a certain price. Okay, whatever the price is less than 10, make them over 10.
You just can't update the key itself.
So it's a different, we need to look at something else. During an update, what can happen?
We can change the key.
We can change the key. We can try to modify, to update the category of the product. And then the system needs to check what?
That's a new value.
That's a new value, it's not there. Good. What do they need to do during deletion?
Nothing.
So it has to check during insert and update, but not during deletion. Very simple. What do we do if we have multiple keys? Now we have seen the theory. Sometimes there are multiple keys. Yes?
Actually, on the previous slide, it needs to validate or delete if there are foreign key relations.
Yes, but that's a different kind of constraint. Two slides later. So we get there. We have seen tables that, based on the functional dependencies, have more than one key. How do we define this in SQL? Exactly like on the screen. We can only pick one. In SQL, there is a single primary key. And all the others, we can declare them if we would like, and we declare them with unique. So for all practical purposes, unique is like a key. But only one is designated as a primary key. Yes?
Can you actually modify the primary key of a tuple?
Can you modify the primary key of a tuple? In theory, yes. In practice,
errors is like saying you can't modify the primary key of a tuple.
It's a tricky question, which I think depends on what a particular database system wants to allow it to do. What do you know?
You can just remove the primary key attribute, change it, and then.
But can you update the primary key? What do people know? Can you update it?
What I remember from the documentation, you can, but if it's an identity attribute, then you can't, unless you set some global flag which allows you to set your own, you know, determine your own identity field, and, you know,
okay,
whatever. Instead of a number, you can put 700.
Except for identities on the
top. Yeah.
Okay, so for our purpose, let's assume that you can update the primary key. My point here is that in addition to the primary key, we can define multiple unique fields. And there is a major distinction which we'll get to that in a second. Now, we want to introduce a second kind of constraint, the foreign key. And you are all experts on foreign keys. See, we have implemented foreign keys in the project. This is a foreign key. What does it say? It says that the product name must do what?
Exist as a value in the name, as a name attribute in the product table.
That it must exist as a name attribute in the product table. And moreover, what is the name attribute in the product table?
Primary.
Must be the primary key.
And the same data type.
Sorry?
And the same data
type. And must have the same data type. Can we have a foreign key to something else than the primary key? To a different attribute? No. So therefore, this is actually redundant. We don't need to write name. The system knows what the primary key is, and you can only have a foreign key into the primary key.
Why can it be to another unique key?
Can you have a foreign key to another unique key? As far as I know, I mean, you're here, some people here are very experts in database, so I need to be cautious. I would say no, but if you want to contradict me, okay, then let's say no. You cannot have a foreign key into unique attributes. That's a major difference between foreign keys and unique attributes. Unique is, this is all you get, uniqueness. A key is like a pointer. You can use that key to point to that record. It's also called a logical pointer. So a foreign key can only refer to a key. It cannot refer to unique attributes. And that is a major distinction. Okay, so now let's examine what happens if we... Okay, so that's a picture of a key-foreign key relationship. This is a foreign key, and this is the key. So let me write here, we can do insert update delete on product. We can do insert update delete on purchase. What does the system need to do? Let's look at here. During an insert, what does it need to check?
Where are we checking?
Oh. We are doing an insert on in purchase. What does it need to check?
Product name exists in the product
table. Product name exists in
the
product.
It needs to check that the product name exists in the product table. Very good. An update.
Well, if we're changing the product name, then same thing.
The same thing. A delete. Nothing. So here needs to check. Here nothing. Here, if we insert in a product, check for duplicates. If we update, check for duplicates. Module of the discussion. No, actually, this is more complicated. So suppose we are allowed to do an update to a key. What does the system need to check now?
You need to make sure that the new value doesn't have any duplicates and the old value didn't have any dependencies.
Exactly. You need to check that the new value does not introduce a duplicate and that there are no foreign keys that point to the old value. Because if there are, after this update, it will be pointing to a non-existing value. So here we need to check two things. Let me write this. And delete. Just a check for references to that particular key. This is what the system needs to do, and it needs to do this very efficiently. So it needs to be optimized to do this. Yes, a question.
Is this, so you're saying this is distinct from the case where when you're doing an update, it changes the values in the purchase table?
When you do an update and it changes the values in the... If you're updating and changing the store, then nothing needs to be checked in this example.
If you're updating a product and you're changing a gizmo to something else,
if you're changing this,
okay. So conceptually, if you change the name of gizmo,
yes.
The database conceptually there is only one thing that's called a gizmo. So I would think that naturally you would rather, on an update operation, change both the product table and the purchase table to be correct, rather than rejecting the operation if there are gizmos in the purchase table.
Okay, so your question actually points to a different question, namely, once the system has detected that the constraint will be violated, what will it do? And we kind of assumed that the system will reject the update, but what you're pointing to is that maybe the system can do something smarter. And you know what? I don't know what the system will do in the case of updates, but I can tell you what it will do in the other cases. And that's something interesting to discuss. Especially here. What can they do in the case of a delete?
Cascade complete.
There are, let's discuss them. So I want to delete a gizmo from product. What should we do?
Remove the gizmo with.
So I want to delete gizmo from here. So choice one is to do what?
Reject.
I also call deny. Choice two.
Cascade completely.
Cascade, you know too well. So cascade. If you don't know what cascade is, wait a second. There is a third choice, which is simpler.
Just leave the row in purchase.
You can't leave the row in purchase because then the foreign key now would be violated, and we don't want to allow this.
Set it to null.
Set to null. Set null just means go here and set this to null. That's a set choice. Let's examine the second choice. The second choice is quite intuitive. It says go and delete this tuple too. Go and delete in addition to the product with the name gizmo, delete all the references to that product. But then why is it called cascade? What's cascade about this? Because there might be other foreign keys into this particular purchase, which might have its own ID, and there might be foreign keys into that. So then you need to delete those as well, and that's what causes a cascade. Okay. So We've seen that. What happens during updates? We've seen that. These are the three policies that we discussed. And these chapters are wrong. They refer to the wrong book. So if you want to read about this, you need to find the right chapters. Good. We have seen so far two kinds of constraints, keys, foreign keys, and you already knew them. The third kind of constraints that we're going to discuss are constraints at the attribute level or at the tuple level. They're quite simple. At the attribute level, we can impose constraints on what values the attribute may take. And the simplest constraint is we may want to say that a certain attribute is not null. Very simple, right? It means it can't be null, right? That's all it says. What other kind of constraints would you like to set on attributes?
Find within a certain range.
Range constraints are very common. Like the price, you want to set it in a certain range, or the age, you want to set it in a certain range. This way you can catch very serious data errors. Yes?
Philosophically speaking, is a data type also a constraint? Like small int versus large int?
Philosophically speaking, a type is a constraint. A type is a predicate. So in some theories, a type is defined as being a predicate. In Lisp, a type is a predicate. In other theories, it's something more simpler than a predicate, in the sense that the theory of types is simpler than first order logic. In SQL, we have types. Datetime is a type, and then separately we have constraints on the values of that type. In SQL, we can write any predicate to constrain the value of an attribute, and that predicate can be quite complicated. It's called a check predicate, and inside the check predicate we can write any statement which includes nested queries. For example, let's see what this says. This checks that the product name is in the result of this SQL query. What does it do? This looks at for all names of the products. So the constraints that is imposed on this predicate looks very similar to something we already know. It's like a foreign key. But still, if we write it like this, the system, there is a major difference between writing it like this and writing it as a foreign key. What's that difference?
R.name doesn't have to be a key.
Actually, there are many differences. Very good. One is that name doesn't have to be a key.
When you delete
write
from
it like
product,
this.
Then you don't have a problem with foreign key. When you delete from the reference table. Isn't this constraint check only on insertion?
This? I wonder whether to postpone this. Let's talk about enforcing this constraint. When does this constraint need to be checked? What is this? Clearly during insertion, right? Insertion around updates, that's easy. But only during insertion, or what else can cause this constraint to be violated? Any change to the product table. Now, we as humans can be smart and understand what the constraint does and figure out that only deletions from this table can affect the constraint. But the system may not be that smart. And in general, if you write a complicated SQL query, it's impossible to figure out when to exactly to check it. You better check it whenever one of the tables that is referred in that SQL query changes. It's very expensive, right? You can write this. If this is important for your database, the system will do it for you, but it's very expensive. Now the other facet, however, is the extra power that you get. Here you can check, for example, that the product name refers to a certain kind of a product, to an expensive product, or to a cheap product, or to a product of a certain category. This is something you cannot express as a foreign key.
It seems like you'd also, in some circumstances, want a one-way check. Like if I were doing an invoice, I would want it to check when I created the invoice, But later on, when I deleted the product from my inventory, I wouldn't want to cascade delete the invoices.
So you're trying to control how the system handles constraint violations?
Well, I'm trying to say like that this is I can think of cases where I'd want a one-way constraint check. Like I would want when I created the record to not violate constraints, but at some future date I wouldn't mind if the constraints were violated because it's preserving historic information. Like I might in 1982 I sold a product called a Gizmo. And yes. That record is still in the database, but today a gizmo doesn't exist. So I still want the invoices, but I don't want to keep that information about what a gizmo is.
Okay, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. So you want to check a property during an update, but you don't care later on if that property is violated.
Right.
That is not a constraint. A constraint is a property that holds on the current state of the database. If you have a historical database, then I think what you want to express, what your example can be expressed over the historical database by just referring to the snapshot that happened at the insert time. But in general, a constraint is different from the way you describe. What you describe is a trigger, and we'll get to this in a few slides. Okay. My point right now is that these kind of constraints are very powerful and very expensive. And they can be further generalized. You can have arbitrary statements, arbitrary predicates that you check on the entire database, and you can define them by creating assertions like this one. And this one just checks a complicated predicate that this cannot exist. Okay, and the system will comply. It will only remember that this constraint refers to these two tables. Whenever one of them changes, it will run the entire query. It will check if there are violations. Okay, so that's the end of the story of constraints. Some details that we didn't discuss. You can give them names. Constraints can have names. So you can later alter the schema, remove constraints or create new constraints. It's important to understand what they mean. I mean, we know what they mean. They're just a first order logic statement. But what do they mean in practical terms? The system needs to take some actions. When are these actions taken? During insertions and deletions and updates? And what exactly do they imply? Sometimes they're cheap, sometimes they're expensive. And you also need to understand what the system does if the constraint is violated. As long as the constraint is satisfied, we understand what happens. But if it's violated, what will the system do? In most cases, it will simply reject the update. But in some cases, it can take some more clever action. And finally, what do database researchers do with constraints? They hope to use constraints in very, very, very clever optimizations. Namely, the idea is to take a query, and based on the constraints, you could rewrite that query into something that is more efficient. And in this example here, this is an example of a constraint-based optimization that is really implemented by most database systems. Look at this query here at the top. It iterates over R and S, and it only returns tuples from R, but it checks that the foreign key in R is equal to the key in S. So what can you do to this query? Unfortunately, it's already on the slide. But this is what the system does. It simply removes the condition on S. The condition on S is like an existential condition. It says, check if there is a matching tuple in S, and only returns those tuples from R that have a matching tuple in S. Let me ask you this way. It's not always a case that you can that the system can rewrite the top query into the bottom query. When can we rewrite the top query into the bottom query? Yes?
When all A's in X are actually referenced from S.
So suppose I give you this. I tell you that X is a foreign key, this attribute here is a foreign key into this key.
Well,
so I know it's a foreign key.
X is not duplicated.
There's a foreign key constraint.
There is a foreign key constraint. I give you this.
You can rewrite that. It's guaranteed to be true if there's a foreign key constraint.
Yes. So you're saying we can always rewrite it.
If there's a constraint, yes.
So my tricky question is this. Even if there is a foreign key, sometimes we cannot rewrite it. Yes.
If two rows in R reference the same row in S, then we're going to get duplication. In the first case, but not in the second case.
Can we get duplications? Is it the case that sometimes we get the same row here is repeated a different number of times than here?
Yeah.
Well, if there is an X that has a witness in S, that witness is unique because it's given by the key. So duplication is not the answer.
If the foreign key is allowed to be null.
That's the answer. If the foreign key is an attribute that can be null, then, if it's null, then there is no matching tuple in S, and that particular tuple will not make it into the results. But in that case, I can rewrite the query into something else. Into what?
SRF key is not null.
Exactly. Select x.a from rx, where not, how do you write it? Is not null or not is null?
Is not null.
A, no, you say a, no, you say r.fk is not null. And it's still better than doing a join, right? This is a form of semantic optimization. And people who worked on this, what they were trying to do is they're trying to take arbitrary constraints, which are in a certain fragment of first order logic, and apply them to queries and rewrite them into something more efficient.
Question?
Yes.
Is null not an allowable value for a primary key?
Is not
the foreign key, we are
talking about the foreign key.
But you're saying that, but what you're saying here is there could never exist a foreign key which has the value null, right? Are you saying that the primary key could not have the value null? Is that why?
The primary key can never be null. So y dot key cannot be null. But here we're talking about x dot foreign key. The foreign key may be null.
Even if it were null, equals wouldn't return the row anyway. Null equals null isn't true.
Null equals null is unknown, and therefore that row would not be returned. So you do not return the rows that are null. Did I answer your question at Microsoft?
Yeah, basically you're saying a primary key can never be null. That's
yes.
Why this works. Okay.
Yes, yeah.
So can you give an example in practice where you'd have a table with a null foreign key? Would the situation be where you had multiple foreign keys in columns in that table? Because theoretically, yes, it makes sense, but in practice, I fail to see when you have a table with a null foreign key.
When you have a table with a null foreign key? Oh, it's actually quite simple. For example, in your project you have orders, right? And the orders refer to products. Maybe you're having an order that has been placed, but no product has been ordered for whatever reason, or the product has been deleted, and then your foreign key becomes null. You don't want to delete the order.
You have a table with people and their cars. I mean, car IDs. People who don't have cars have null for their car IDs.
Yes. Yeah. So you can argue that in many applications, the foreign key is not null, but it's in some tables it can be null. Is it a good time to take a break now?
Yeah.
Okay, a 6 minutes break.
So two announcements about the homework and about the project. The homework has been graded this morning, actually. So UN did an excellent job grading the homework quickly, and it's just a miscommunication between our emails that we should have emailed you the grades by now. But the only reason why we haven't done this is because of email So the first homework is graded. The second phase of the project will be posted probably no earlier than Thursday, probably on Thursday. So I know some of you want to work on it as soon as possible, and we are trying hard to get it posted. But we also these are new entries to test it and to update it. So it's a lot of work. The other thing is, we only have one DA. And by the way, have you met Nguyen?
She's right. Your mic is off.
Did anyone hear me at Microsoft?
We can hear you. Yeah. We can hear you.
Even without the mic.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah, yeah. Much.
Much better. Okay. So I was saying that the homework is graded. We will send out the scores as soon as possible.
We haven't met Nguyen yet. Could you zoom the camera in on her? Or have her come up to the front. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you zoom in the camera on Nguyen, or should he come? Should she come here? Come here.
Oh, yeah.
She looks exhausted because she graded her homework.
Thank you.
Thanks. We only have one TA. And two different major things to grade, four homeworks, four project phases. So I'm going to give Nguyen a break with the project. She will grade phases one and two together, and then three and four together. Basically, some of you don't need any feedback on the project. Some of you do need feedback on the project. It depends on your background. So I think that's life. We have to postpone grading of the first phase of the project for another 2-3 weeks. Okay. And that's it. So we finished our discussion on constraints. Triggers, think of them as an alternative way to deal with a similar problem as that one dealt with by constraints, namely with data integrity. A trigger is just a procedure that is invoked by the database management system whenever there is an update to the database. A trigger is a combination of an event, the event is insert, delete, or update, a condition, it's something to check when the trigger is to be activated, and then the action. What does the trigger need to do? I'm going to give a very brief overview of triggers. I'm not a big fan of triggers. Triggers have some major problems. So let me go directly to an example. Now, why doesn't it go? Finally, here is my first example. So let's read this. Create trigger, that's easy. That's the name of the trigger, insert promotions. The first thing that the trigger specifies is the event. The event is update. It says after an update. It can also say before the update, or it can say instead of the update. In this example, it says after an update. After an update of what? Of the price attribute on product. Which means this trigger is waiting for an update statement on the price attribute of product. Now, not all the updates will cause this trigger to fire. Only some updates. Which ones? That is captured by the condition, by the when condition. Now, the when condition can refer to both the old value and the new value, to the old price and the new price. We need to say to the trigger, we need to tell the trigger how we refer to the old value and the new value. And this is what we say here. We refer to the old value as the old tuple, and we refer to the new value as the new tuple. And now the when condition is pretty clear. What does it say? The trigger is activated when?
Price goes down.
When the price goes down. And what do we do when the price goes down? What is the action? We insert in promotions what? A new tuple with the same name as the price, as a product being promoted, and with a discount value which is computed, well, it's kind of a fraction by which it decreases. That's the whole trick. Now notice that the action is an insert. So what can happen in this case? There might be another trigger that's waiting on the promotions, and that trigger may do it can do anything it wants. For example, it can update the price of some product, which in turn may trigger an insertion in promotion and so on. So that's a danger with triggers. They can be recursive. This is why they are also very hard to understand. When you look at a set of triggers, figuring out what will happen is very difficult. Okay, so a few details and then we'll move on. The events can be insert, delete, update. They can be after, or they can be instead. I said they can also be before, but apparently I was wrong. I wish they could be before. I don't know why they are not before. Now the scope is interesting, so let me go back here. You might have noticed this for each row. Now, this particular event is triggered by an update. An update, if you remember the slides from the first lecture, which we haven't discussed, but you should read them. An update is a very powerful statement. It can update many tuples in the table. We can say, for example, update all products in the toys category. Decrease our price by some amount that we specify. So a single SQL statement may update many tuples. Now, how should the trigger be triggered? Should it be triggered after each tuple being updated, or at the very end after we update all the tuples? Well, this is exactly what we control through this statement. In this case, we trigger the update after every row that's being updated. And the other choice is, so this is for each row. The other choice is to trigger it for the after the entire statement. So in that case, we cannot talk about the current row being updated. But what we can do, we can talk about the entire table that was updated. So take the old table and take the new table, and now we can have a condition that compares these two tables. You can see how powerful triggers are, and also how difficult it is to reason about them. So that's an example of the usage of for each statement. I'm not going to read this example. It does some complicated thing. And here, notice the use of instead of. So this trigger essentially overrides a certain kind of an update. You want to update, and the trigger will say, no, you don't update. I'm going to decide what to do, if that's what you want to update. So they are very powerful mechanisms. And they can be recursive, like in this example. This is a bad trigger because it's an after update, and what does it do? The action, what it does, it updates again, and that means that it's recursive, so it will never terminate. We have to debug a non-terminating set of triggers, which is a nightmare. Good. So I don't want you to remember the details of the triggers. This is something you can study at home by looking at the slides, reading the book. The book contains very little information. Most of these examples are based on the other book by Ullmann and Hector Garcia Marina in Widom. But what I would like you to do now is to have this discussion comparing triggers with constraints. You can imagine using triggers to enforce constraints. How? If we didn't have, for example, keys, foreign keys, but we had triggers in our database system, how can you enforce constraints? How can you enforce a key, foreign key constraint?
You have to delete the row that's updated?
Yes, please, go ahead.
Have to delete the row that you just updated if the constraint isn't met?
So we need to write how many triggers for a key foreign key constraint? About
six.
One for each type of update. And then just do the right thing, right? And each trigger we just check the right condition and we do the right action. Now we also need to say don't do it if there is an update that, if there is an insert. I actually don't know how to write it, but I'm sure there is a way. I'm sure there is a way in the trigger to say this insert has to be denied. So, yep, triggers can be used to enforce integrity constraints. Which ones should we use? Should we use integrity constraints or triggers?
Constraints.
They are easier to understand and they are more efficient to implement for what they are doing. However, constraints are more powerful. Sometimes we use constraints because they can express something more powerful than triggers. Somebody from Microsoft gave this example in which you want to check a condition, but only during the insertion. After the insertion, the condition might be violated. Like you want to check the certain referential integrity constraint. You want to check that this order refers to an existing product. But you want to insert it only when the order is placed. Later you would like to allow the product to be deleted. That's not a constraint. That's a trigger. During the trigger you can check that the product exists and then later the product can be deleted.
Question, can a foreign key be composed of multiple attributes?
Can a foreign key be composed of multiple attributes? Everybody should know the answer. Can I have a foreign key that consists of more than one attribute?
Sure,
yes. Do I have a choice? If I want to refer to table customers, do I have a choice of how many attributes I put in the foreign key?
No.
Exactly how many attributes there are in customers, this is how many attributes I need to use a foreign key into customers. Does it make sense? Okay. So, any other thoughts about triggers? Then let's move on to views. And here I have a long discussion. I think I have time to cover everything I needed to cover. And I'm going to start with a standard textbook approach to views. Views are like subroutines, like procedures in SQL. We write an SQL query, and then we give it a name. The query, what does a query return in general? Every SQL query returns tuples, a table, right? So if we give name to this answer, we essentially have like a table. A view is like a table. In this example, what kind of table is it? So here we define developers to be a view having how many attributes? Two attributes, name and project, and it logically corresponds to some employees, but only employees in the development department, and it only contains their names and their projects. Okay, that's a view. So let's see how to use it. Well, since it's like here is another example, sorry. I'd like to go through this example. here the query computes a join between purchase and products and returns the customer and the price. So why? Oh, because a product is a foreign key here. So this is what we return. We return the customer and the price. So the intuition is that it tells us for each customer how much they paid. This is what this view computes. Now this is a table, which is called a virtual table, because it doesn't really exist. It's computed on demand. Let's see how we would use it. So now we have the schema that has the base tables, but it also has this new table, which is a view. It also has a view. And we can use a view anywhere in SQL where we normally use a table. Like, for example, in this query here, we use customer price in the table. What this query does is not that important. It joins the customer price table with purchases and then selects only those whose price is greater than 100 and returns the store. So this is how we think about views. The views are defined by an SQL expression, and we can think of them as either the definition, which is the query defining them, or the answer, the table that results out of that definition. And we can use that table anywhere in SQL. Now the question, when is this view computed? Is it computed when we define it, when we create a view? Is this when we fill the table, or later when the query is evaluated? During evaluation. But actually this is just a default behavior. Both approaches make sense. In the first case we call it a virtual view. This is a default. This was the initial usage of views, and that's a standard usage in SQL. Virtual, because that table is only computed on the fly. The other approach is to materialize it. Then we have a materialized view. And actually, in SQL now there is materialized keyword, right? You can declare views to be materialized. What are the pros and cons of a virtual view and a materialized view? What do we, yes?
Well, the cons of the virtual view is that you have to do the joins and or calculations in the selects. And materialized, you have to have storage for that the same data redundantly. They might be out of date.
So he talked about efficiency. He said that, right, but let's summarize. Which one is more efficient, the virtual view or the materialized view at query time?
Materialized.
The materialized view is more efficient. It's already computed. We don't have to worry about it. What about the definition time when we define it?
Virtual.
And the virtual view. And then you have to compute nothing. So then why don't we materialize all the time? Sorry? It's out of date. Now that's a problem with the materialized views. They get out of sync with the original data.
And it actually requires extra storage.
And they require extra storage. But storage... yeah, they do require extra storage, and that is a cost.
How come it's not updated every time you get new data in the other tables?
So you could do this. Every time the base table is updated, you can update the materialized view. But then you're increasing the cost of updating the base tables a lot, because all the derived materialized views need to be updated.
Oh, so the database doesn't maintain the view up to date. It's like creating another table in this case.
The database would we come to this. So
could we upgrade it at each query? Every time it's used?
You could do this. Updates we'll discuss in a few slides. Okay? So let's be organized. Here is what I would like to discuss. I would like to discuss first virtual views and then materialized views. And these discussions are not always completely separated. For virtual views, the first thing is, let's discuss how to use them inside queries. That's called query modification, or query rewriting, or inlining. Then I'm going to show you some interesting applications of views, of virtual views, and separately of materialized. Then a classical problem, updating views. And finally, a problem that's kind of orthogonal to views, but it's inspired by views, query minimization. So let me start with what happens with a virtual view when we use it in a query. So I'm reusing this view, customer price, does a join on purchase and product, and returns something from purchase, the customer from purchase, and the price from product. So now the query joins the customer price with purchase. What happens at runtime? What will the system do? Will it compute the customer price table first and then run this query over that table?
Well, according to the semantics you gave early on, it should compute customer price first.
The semantics is that one that you just described over there at Microsoft. It, semantically, it should first compute customer price and then apply this query on the result. But of course, it can optimize this. So what would be a smart thing to do?
Translate it to a single select query.
Yes, translate it into a single select query. But as a first step, something even simpler. Just replace the definition of customer price with a view definition, which is right here. Right? So now we have a nested query, something we try to avoid whenever we can. So before the system runs this query, it needs to ask a basic question. Can it be flattened? Can we flatten this query? Yes, of course. So, and then the result is this. It's a query with three lines. The red part comes from inlining the views, and the black part is what was part of the original query. So this is what happens at runtime. And as you see, now the join between purchase and product is no longer computed in full, because now we have selections on product. Only certain products are joined with purchase, which is much more efficient than materializing the entire view. So this is called query modification, or view inlining, or query expansion, or view expansion. They all mean the same thing. Takes a view definition, plug it in into the query. One thing we notice immediately, once you plug in the view definition, we get a nested query. So if you thought users are smart and they avoid writing nested queries, you can implement a database management system that ignores nested queries, but you still need to deal with them. Because in view expansion, you introduce nested queries even if your users don't do this. So let's reason a little bit about now what is interesting here. Yeah, let's reason a little bit about flattening queries.
Question?
Yes.
In the previous slide, are we missing the price from the selection?
It could be the case. So is there an error here? Do we need to include the price in the selection? Let me go back to the query. The query was, the query did not want the price. Customer price had a price, but the query didn't want the price. So here there is no price. There is a price here, but there is no price in the select. So after the expansion, we don't need a price. So this is very interesting actually to observe. During this query modification, certain attributes that were important, that looked like important in the view, are no longer used. But now I'd like to look deeper into flattening. The change here is this distinct. Before, we didn't have any distinct, and the end result was this. Now I added the distinct just to the query, and the view is the same. Can I still flatten this? Well, the answer cannot be this, right? Because here there is no distinct. Or maybe this is what you're claiming, that I can...
Well, if you add a distinct to this...
So this what's right now on the screen, that this is the expansion, this is the modification of the query without distinct. My question is, how does the if the query had distinct, like here, what is the corresponding expansion?
For distinct in the other query.
Yes. In this particular case, and we will look deeper why that's the case, we can still do the expansion, we just have to add distinct in the expanded query. But this point said that we need to be concerned about the usage of distinct. And this is a major headache for the part of the optimizer that deals with flattening nested queries. The correct usage of distinct, the correct treatment of distinct. So database people talk about set semantics versus back semantics. When you write a query like this, select distinct, this has set semantics in the sense that it computes a set, and the axioms of set theory hold, idempotence holds. There are no duplicates. We understand this by thinking about sets. If there are no distincts, then we call it, we say that it has bag semantics. The result is a bag or a multiset. So now I can describe the flattening problem by considering four cases, depending on which query, the inner or the outer query, had set or bag semantics. The first one is when we have distinct in both cases. Then I hope you agree with me that in this case we can flatten. Right? Well, I'm going to allow you to think a little about this. Is this correct? Let me ask you this way. It's correct, right? So let's read the details. What does it do? This iterates over the inner query. Iterates over R and S, has some join conditions. Returns a set of UVs and then uses that to iterate and iterate over the result and over T, and then has more join conditions and returns ABCs. And the flattened query simply flattens R and S and iterates over R and S and over T. Now when it considers pairs of R and S, of course there are no more duplicates, because here it had eliminated the UV duplicates. So now there are more iterations over RS than there were in the nested query here. So let me do it this way. In one, there are more iterations than, there are fewer iterations than in two. The number of tuples in one is less than or equal to the number of tuples in two, in the RS pair on the right. However, what is important here is the distinct at the end. It doesn't matter, because the extra tuples in the second, in number two, they will all correspond to the same A, Bs, and Cs. They actually correspond to exactly the same tuples. They are indistinguishable because we only look at the U's and V's for the subquery. So this is why the outer distinct removes any distinction between the two queries. So then, if you understood this, let me ask you this. Suppose I write this select distinct, and in the inner query, there is no distinct. It's just select from where. Can I flatten this? And then what? Yes, I can flatten this. And essentially, it's exactly the same query. What happens if I don't have a distinct in either places? Can I still flatten it? Yes. Now we do care about duplicates, but it turns out it's the same number. And the last case is when there is no distinct here, but there is a distinct here. Then we cannot flatten. So let's see them. So I'm going to erase this. Now go slowly through the slides. So set semantics is okay, and we get a set semantics. The next case is set back semantics. This can also be flattened, and we get a set semantics. The next case is back semantics. This can also be flattened, and we get a back. And the last case is this, bag and set semantics. So the point here is that the inner query here eliminates duplicates and only retains a certain number of UV, one distinct tuple UV for each distinct value of U and V. The outer query, however, may keep duplicates. There might be duplicated ABCs. Exactly how many depends on the particular combination of R, S, and T tables. But if you try to flatten, you can't put a distinct at the end. And if you don't put distinct, then this duplicate elimination of UV that happened here is lost. You can't reproduce that. So this kind of nested query cannot be flattened. There is another way to look about this. There is another construct in SQL that we know and love, and that is very similar to distinct. Group I. And actually, SQL implementers, they never worry about distinct. They only worry about group I. This query, select AB from blah, group I AB, is the same as what? There is no aggregation here. This is the same as what? Select distinct AB from something. So essentially what's another way to read this this particular example here is that if we have a group I in the inner query, if we compute an aggregate and then iterate over that aggregate, that's something we cannot flatten. That's something that has to stay expressed as a subquery. Okay. Let me remind you the context of our discussion. We are discussing these flattening rules because this is something the system needs to perform when we use during the query modification. The queries might become nested, and then the system needs to unnest them using rules like this. Good. So I think at this point we understand pretty well how the system modifies a query. Let's see some interesting applications of use. I'm going to show you two. One is something called logical data independence. And the second is in security. So what is physical data independence?
Well, we don't care how the file system stores it. Where on the disk it exists.
So what he said is we don't care where the files are stored and how they are organized. We don't care what indexes are built for the database. All we see are these logical tables. And underneath they can be organized as B trees, as B plus trees, or it can several files, or maybe partitioned across different disks. The system will take care of that. This is the independence between the logical view of the data, the logical model, and the physical storage. What is logical data independence? It's the idea that sometimes even at the logical level, we may want to have a different logical organization of the database than what the application perceives. For example, suppose we have a table of resumes. It's a job applications database. And it has many attributes. We decide to store it into several tables, T1, T2, T3. This is called vertical partitioning. it reminds you of decomposition, right? But it's different from decomposition. There was nothing wrong with the resumes. It was already normalized. SSN was a key. But sometimes we still would like to partition it vertically. And you might have encountered this kind of partitioning in your work. Why would we ever care about partitioning a table vertically?
Data type is very large.
Exactly. When it's too wide. It's too wide, and then it may become inefficient. For example, there is a picture here. You don't want to store the picture, which is very rarely accessed, together with these high demand attributes that might be accessed by many queries. So let's separate them. Put the picture in one table and store these in a different table. Sometimes you may use a system like Oracle that when he accepts so many attributes per table. If you have a table with 10,000 attributes, if that's what your customer wants, you give him 10,000 attributes. But now you have to partition it vertically because you can't store it in the table with 10,000 attributes. Sometimes you need to distribute it. Pictures can only be stored in that system that is allowed to store the pictures. They are highly sensitive. They have to be encrypted, whatever. So you need to distribute the data, and then you partition it vertically in order to distribute it. These are the reasons why we would partition it. However, the application sees this. So how can we ensure that all applications are written in terms of the resume table, while in fact the data is stored in T1, T2, T3? Define a view. That's the beauty of views. So we do this. We create a view that does exactly the join between the three tables. And we answered this, right? We discussed why we would like to partition. So now let's examine a query. This is a typical query. It says, find the address of Sue over the resume table. But resume is a view. So now the system does a query modification. It does some optimizations, which are obvious. In the end, it will touch which tables? Just T1, because T1 contains both the name and the address, and after the join, it doesn't need T2 and T3. Somebody asked me when in practice, somebody asked this question, but I'm not sure. There was this semantic optimization that if you do a join with a foreign key, that join is redundant. Right? Remember we had this discussion. We were joining a table on a foreign key with another table, and the other table was not used in the query in any other way. So that was redundant. That's exactly the rule that is applied here. Resume is a join between T1 and T2 and T3. However, only address and name are used, and they are both in T1. So we end up joining on a foreign key into T2 and T3, SSN, which is both a key and a foreign key. And therefore, these two joins are redundant. So that is precisely the rule that allows us to express this query only over T1.
But the database knows actually that it can leave out T2 and T3, because if one of the foreign keys is null, won't the full query come back with zero? Like if Sue doesn't have a picture,
right?
And wouldn't that mean that it would come back as no rows if it was the full?
Right, so the discussion is what happens if some of these foreign keys are null. Should we allow these foreign keys to be null in this example? So here SSN in each case is both a key and it's a foreign key. Now here is an interesting question. This SSN is a foreign key to where? To two places. I swear, it's the first time in my life that I ever asked this stupid question. Can you have a an attribute that's a foreign key into two different tables. Can you? I don't know. I have no clue. But this is what we need here. We need this SSN to be a foreign key both into SSN of T2 and into SSN of T3.
Yep.
Right? We want to say that these are very tightly connected. Let's assume for the purpose of our discussion that we can do this. This is what we need, so the system better deliver. So our SSN, they are very tightly connected. They are foreign keys into each other. The question is, should we allow them to be null? We can't, right, because they're also keys. So end of the story. They cannot be null. Does this answer your question?
Yeah,
sure. Oh, you're right here. Yeah. Good. And my point is, it's exactly this foreign key information that allows the system to optimize this query and to make it talk only to T1. Things fit very nicely together. Good. The second kind of application is a horizontal partitioning. The vertical partitioning was vertical. The horizontal partitioning is horizontal. For example, here we have customers, and we would like to partition them based on the city. Customers in Houston, customers in Seattle, customers in Portland. Oh, and by the way, all the customers in Canada, they should go into the same partition. This is called vertical partitioning. Why would we do this? Essentially for the same reasons as before. Maybe for efficiency reasons. Maybe it's a huge table, but most of the queries are in Canada. So then you would like to separate Canada. Or most of the queries are over a very small subset. I'm actually now working on the graduate admission. So we are. This is what consumes my time. This is why when I don't reply to email, it's because I'm busy doing graduate admission. And what happens in the case of graduate admissions is that we are storing all the applications, all the historical applications in the same database. So this was now a question. We do a lot of work, and we want to have very efficient queries right now on the current applications, not on the ones from 5 years ago, but they are stored on the same database. How would you recommend a good organization of this database? Partition them by years or by status, if it's active or if it's archived. So that's exactly the idea of partitioning. You try to isolate the high traffic data. The data that is queried over and over again, you want to partition it and separate.
Another used to be maybe just databases split over different physical spaces, so you put the Seattle database on a Seattle disk or something.
Exactly. A very good point. So the second reason is maybe you want to distribute it. You want to, distribute the data.
Also for permissions too, would it be possible to, in this case, let's say you have some people that could only look at the Houston customers, so they don't have the privileges in Seattle or Canada. Would that be possible without partitioning it horizontally?
So the question is, can you do this for security? It's a complicated story that I'd like to defer when we discuss security. I actually have a few slides on security. Yes and no. If you define it as a view, then I don't think you can actually do it this way. Okay, let me focus on just partitioning and query modification. So, this is what we do. We create again customers, it's a view, but now it's a union. What does union all mean? Sorry?
Whatever's including duplicates.
Include duplicates. Do we care here if we include duplicates or not? No, because we will not store the same tuple in two tables. They are partitioned based on the city attribute. But which one is more efficient? Union or union all? Union all is more efficient. Good. So now, let's ask us a simple query. Find all of the customers in Seattle. And again, customers is this view. It's a union of the customers in Houston, the customers in Seattle, customers in Canada. The database system will modify this query, and in the end, after it does all the optimizations, my question to you is, will it do the right thing? Will it go only to the customers in Seattle table and fetch the customers from there, or not? What do you think?
I think it only to the constraint saying that it has to be Seattle.
Right. There is no way. I mean, if you just look at this definition, nothing here tells you that the tuples in this table are in Seattle. But there might be a hint in the name. Of course, this is no guarantee. This table may contain any customers, even in New York, and vice versa. The customers in this table might be in Seattle. So I have my own solution, but I would like to ask you, how would you reorganize this view? How can you help the system optimize? We can't walk away from this, right? We really want to make sure that queries like this are evaluated efficiently. How? Yes.
Okay.
Whichever. Yeah.
If you said in the union for each of those subtables, you said select where city equals Seattle, city equals Houston.
Exactly. Did people hear at Microsoft?
Yes.
So we give the system a hint. We write a much more complicated view, and some people might wonder, some of our friends might wonder why we do this, but we do it for a purpose. We explain to the system that we only select from customers in Houston those customers that actually live in Houston. This will be all the customers, right? Because we make sure we only store customers in Houston there. But it's a tremendous help for the system, because now when it expands in the original query here, after it pushes down the selections through the union, it will discover that for most of the unions, the selection is false. It returns the empty set. Only for one of the tables, it returns stuff. And actually, this is not the correct rewriting. For all it knows, the system also needs to add the condition.
Question.
Yes.
Could we accomplish the same thing by setting a constraint on the customers in Seattle table and the customers in Houston table, so we have a check on that, on the city, so that the check requires the city be Houston for them to be in that table?
Very good question. I think the answer is yes. I mean, I don't. I think that's a better solution than the one I gave. I think that's a better solution.
Well, but aren't constraints inefficient? I mean, the system will have to check it every time.
I guess that's the second half of my question is will the database then optimize based on that?
The database will definitely optimize. Let me think. How would you describe that constraint? I'm not sure if there is a constraint which can say this attribute is constant, but there should be. Right, because this is a very typical kind of application. I want to say that the city attribute in T1, or in this table, is constant. It must be Seattle, and I'm pretty sure there is such a constraint, which is easy to enforce. Whenever there is a tuple inserted in that table, you just need to check that it's in Seattle, and it's easy to use during query optimization. So. If I were to implement this, I would look carefully at constraints. It seems to be the better choice. Yes?
And I'm thinking that storing the Seattle value in that column doesn't make any sense. You can just generate the value when somebody queries that table.
That's an even better solution. Don't store the city in the local tables, but generate it on the fly. Yep. So two solutions better than mine. So. How would we write the query in this case? Should I write it or is it clear? So now customers in Houston, they don't have a city at all. There is no city. But we're still in this union. We need to return the city. How do we do this?
The city,
star comma Houston heads.
So we say select star comma Houston as city. That's what we do. Yep. It's an even better solution. And the system now should be able to optimize queries like this very easily. Views are beautiful. Let's see more stuff.
Sure. When you're doing the partitioning, so now we've split the rows across three separate tables, but they all are logically sharing the same primary key here, the social security number. How can we make sure that in each of those three separate tables there aren't duplicate keys?
Okay, so the question is, when we partition the views, how can we, when we partition the table, how can we ensure that there are no duplicate social security numbers across these tables? I see, this is for the horizontal partitioning. For the vertical one, it's trivial, because we have foreign keys. It's a very good question. Here is his observation. This is like a global key, right? And I don't know of any simple way, except as to write a complex constraint. Yes?
Why not just have a vertical table that just has SSN, and that would be primary key, and the SSN and most is the foreign key?
You're much more awake than I am. Very good, beautiful. So to enforce that constraint, if that's important, which I think it is, we would have a separate table of SSNs, and then each of these will be declared to be a foreign key, but it's still not good. Because you can have
printables. So that'll still allow duplicate printables, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so I can have a customer in Houston and a customer in Seattle that still has the same social security number.
Yeah.
Two customers.
So you, I, from well, here on,
a table or something.
From here on, we can invent and speculate. You can organize this table such that it does something right. But the answer is it depends. So you can enforce it either with additional with an additional table or just by just writing a constraint. Okay. So that was horizontal partitioning. So that's the idea of logical data independence. We may decide to store the data in a different tables than the ones that are in the logical schema. And then the connection between the underlying schema and the logical, our exposed or user logical schema is done through a view or through several views. The second class of applications of views are in security. And here I want to go pretty quickly because we will have a separate lecture on security. The idea is very simple. Some parts of a table contain sensitive data. We want to control which users are allowed to see that part of the table. The simplest example is the classical example is with salary. Okay, we have names and position and phone number and salary, and everybody is allowed to see the entire table except salary. Only people in payroll can see salary. This example is similar. Here the balance is restricted. Fred is allowed to see the entire table, but not the balance. How can we restrict Fred from seeing the balance? Well, we create a view for Fred and for other users like Fred, where we only include what they are allowed to see, the name and address. And we don't allow Fred to access customer, but we allow him to access the public customers. And this is how we use views to control access to data. We can use more complicated views, for example, to give Fred or John access to only a subset of the rows. Exactly the same idea. We use a view to restrict the data to which a certain user has access. Good. So these were the applications. Now, we are still within virtual views. We haven't moved on to materialized views yet. We'll do this in a moment. But before that, I need to discuss with you a classical and very nasty problem with virtual views. Here is the issue. I said that a view is like a table, right? We create a view, and now we refer to it whenever we are allowed to use a table. We should be allowed to use that view instead. But it's not quite so with updates. If we would like, sometimes it's convenient to think about updating a view. Let's take this example here. In this case, the view is just a subset of the products. It's a set of all expensive products. So it's a table which has the same structure, which only has one attribute, product name. It contains only expensive products. So what happens if we insert into expensive products a product called Gizmo? There is no expensive product table, right? We need to insert something in product. So in this case, it seems to be simple. We insert in product a new product whose name is Gizmo. We don't know the price, so we just set a null. Now this has a kind of a weird consequence, right? This will work, I think.
Product.
Sorry.
But then, it's not inexpensive product because it doesn't meet the wear condition on the product.
Exactly. So we have inserted it, but now it doesn't show up in the view. So we may want to insert it again. This illustrates a friction between views, which are this beautiful concept, and the idea of updating. You can't really update a view. Sometimes you can in very restricted settings, but in most cases you can't. And that's the message of these four or five slides. I'm going to skip this discussion. Let me tell you the highlights of view updates. This was a problem that was studied theoretically in the early 80s. What has remained since then are a long set of rules in the SQL standard that tell you when a view is updatable. And I think the view we had before is updatable, but I'm not 100% sure. So some views are updatable according to the standard. So then the system needs to know how to translate an update over the view into an update over the base tables. Other views are not updatable, and the system will simply refuse updates.
Question.
Yes.
For bizarre cases, can you put a trigger on a view so that it, and then put the right logic into the trigger so that it does what you really want it to do?
That's an interesting question. So can you put can you capture updates on a view through a trigger? And then the application will decide what to do, which makes much more sense. I don't know the answer. I don't know if technically you can allow a view, non-updatable view, to be updated only to catch the update through a trigger. But it makes perfectly sense as a conceptual approach. Okay, so here is what I'm going to do next. I'm going to skip this discussion on query minimization, which is a beautiful discussion, but we're running out of time. I want to discuss materialized views. Where is it? Which creates a new set of problems. And I think I want to spend the remaining 20 minutes discussing these problems. So now, the views are actually computed, and they are stored. And therefore, queries that execute over these views are much more efficient. Materialized views you won't believe where they occur. For example, indexes. An index is just a materialized view. And I will give a very concrete example that makes use of this. Views and data warehouses. Somebody mentioned data mining today. Data warehouses are essentially denormalized tables. They are like big joints, and the typical queries that you would like to compute on this big table are aggregate queries with group bys. Group bys by various criteria. They're very expensive. So what data warehouses tend to do, they tend to pre-compute some of these group bys. So now we have a materialized view that contains a group by. data distribution or data replication is again another instance of a materialized view. You compute a query, you ship it to a different site, and now you have a materialized view on the other side. Something else, semantic caching, which I forgot to put here, but we have I have a discussion later on. So we will see this term. So let's see the issues that we need to deal with materialized views. The first is synchronization. Somebody mentioned this. Since we have materialized a view, it's no longer the data it stores is no longer fresh. We need to worry about when to update it, whenever the underlying data gets updated. And the second problem that we're going to discuss is, okay, now we have these materialized views sitting around. How can we use them during query processing? And I'm not going to discuss about view selection. So let's think a little about synchronization. And this is something we discussed earlier today. If the base table gets updated, what should we do with the view? What are the options? One is to update early. Whenever the table gets updated, we immediately recompute the view. Or we can do something more clever. We can maybe try to do a so-called incremental update on the view. But then we need to understand how the update on the base table gets translated into an update on the view. And this is something we will discuss. So this is immediate synchronization. The other is we defer synchronization. For example, a lazy one would be at query time. Whenever you ask a query, somebody suggested this today. Seems to make sense in some applications. Whenever there is a query on the view, you quickly recompute the view, and now you have, you only recompute it if you see that the base tables have been updated. You do some timestamp check. And if it's the case, then you recompute the view. The most commonly used in practice is aperiodic. We do this in this graduate admissions database. We recompute the GREs periodically because they are complicated aggregates over all the history of all the GREs that the student has taken. It's either the average or the maximum or the last one, something like this. And it's a very expensive aggregate. We compute this overnight. Or it can be manual. It can be forced. So out of these view synchronization policies, the interesting aspect is the incremental view update. But actually, let me ask you this. In the case of an index, which synchronization policy would you recommend? The immediate one, right? Indexes, they need to be up to date. In the case of a data warehouse, the data warehouse itself is a view. That's periodic. Data warehouses are recomputed once overnight or maybe weekly, and it's okay if they are not up to date because they are supposed to support decision to answer decision support queries. Okay, so this is exactly what I was telling you about the GRE scores, and you can read the slides at home. So how can you be clever about updating a materialized view? Let's study this. The view here is a join between order and product. And all it does is it actually computes a join. So inside order, the key here is the pair. So order has this foreign key into product. So after computing the view, we have just a join between order and product. Every order comes together with a product it refers to. Now, suppose I do this. I'm going to update the price of the product, of some product. Clearly, some of the tuples in this join are affected. Which tuples? Some tuples need to be updated. one tuple or multiple tuples? Multiple tuples. Now this is an interesting observation. We only updated a single product because we selected this key. But in the materialized view, this affects multiple tuples. But it's really easy to see that in this case, we need to do this update. Is there a question? This is called an incremental update, because instead of recomputing the entire materialized view, we have only updated what was needed. Okay, sometimes it's not that easy. Sometimes the incremental update can be done if you store additional data structures. This happens especially when we do duplicate elimination or when we have aggregates. Look at this trivial example. Here we create a view of all distinct categories. And now what we do is that we delete a product. Just one single product from the product database. It had a category. Should we delete a corresponding category from categories? If we were to delete it, we would do it like this. We would go to categories and delete all those entries whose category is our category. You could argue that no, we shouldn't delete because there might be other products, but how can we make the difference? We can check here. Now I realize as we are discussing this, we can write a more clever query that checks. You need to refer to both the old product table and the new product table, right? And now you need to check if there are any remaining products with the same category, and then we know whether to delete or not. But sometimes we don't have access. Sometimes what happens is that these are separated physically. This is on one server, the product is in server 1, and the categories are in server 2. This is one reason why we compute materialized views. We might want to distribute the data. So then queries like the one I have on the screen are difficult to write, just because you can't communicate the entire table. That this is what you want to avoid. So you would like to communicate only the parameters of the update, and it becomes very tricky. One observation here is that you can send just a category and then we know what to delete, but how do we know if that's the last category? Here we can be smart. We can store this view as a view with duplicates by counting for each category how many times it's still there. And then whenever it gets deleted, we just decrement that counter. Sometimes we can't be so smart. Bottom line, incremental view updates. Oops. Let me write here the summary. Sometimes yes. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes it's hard. And sometimes it's impossible. I think this is a major conclusion. And exactly how to do this, it's difficult. It depends on the query. And the theory of incremental view updates, that was a research area in the early 90s. And by now people, understand the limit pretty well. Okay, the other interesting tweak to materialized views is the following. We have a query that is a standard query over the base tables. But the system knows that there are some materialized views sitting around. And the system would like to be smart. Instead of evaluating the query on these base tables, it may try to rewrite the query in terms of these materialized views, because sometimes in this way it's more efficient. This is called answering queries using views problem, or rewriting the queries using views problems. Rewriting is better for our purposes. answering this when we might be able to answer it even if we don't know how to rewrite it as a query. So let's stick to rewriting. Let me give you some examples first, and then some surprising applications. So here, now wake up. I need to show you some pretty deep examples. This is a view, the top thing. What does it do? It joins person and purchase by joining the foreign key buyer to the person name. And it also does some selection. It only returns those persons that are in Java. And then returns lots of stuff. Buyer, seller. Actually, it's interesting. All the attributes that it returns are from where? From purchase. This is the view. But now, we have this query. This was a view, and this is a query. The question is, can we answer this query without going to the person and purchase tables by just using the view? Yes, why is that? So actually, let me write it. How would we write? You would say select from Seattle view Seattle view X. So what do we select? X buyer and seller, no?
Yeah.
Buyer, X seller, and any conditions? And X dot product is Gizmo. Why not Seattle? Why not city equals Seattle? Because this is already here. Good. So here is an example. If this view was sitting around, we can actually be much more efficient. We can evaluate the query directly on the view. Example two. It was here. Sorry, this is the rewritten query, and that was the original query. Example 2. The view is the same, but now we want to answer this query. That in addition to the previous one, is this condition on the phone. It wants only persons with a certain phone. This is, by the way, this is a University of Washington exchange phone. So it has a semantic. Okay, we only want buyers who work for the university. Can we answer this query? No, because the view doesn't tell us anything about the phone number. It illustrates the subtleties, which you probably were expecting these subtleties. We need to be very careful how we use those views in order to answer the query. Notice it's the other direction than in query modification. In query modification, the query is written directly over the views. It's easy to expand. We just worry about flattening. This is a much harder problem. Because the view is written over the base tables, the query is written over the base tables. So how do you rewrite the query to use just the views without referring to the base tables? It's not clear. This is an example where it's not possible.
Can you still use the materialized view though to make the end query more efficient?
Sometimes you can do this. You can use a materialized view together with the base tables. Sometimes you have access to both of them, and we'll discuss some applications.
So in this case, instead of joining the person table with the purchase, you could join the view with purchase.
In this case, yeah, I think you're right. In this case, you can join Seattle view with person, exactly. And it might be the case that this is more efficient than going to the base table. And finally, two more examples, and actually let me skip them, and I would invite you to look at them at home. They illustrate even more subtleties, and this in particular is about aggregates. Three examples, so please read them at home. The general problem is this: we have views, and we have a query which doesn't know about the views. That makes it difficult. The question is, can we rewrite the query to use the views, to use them exclusively? That's a full rewriting, or to use both the views and the base tables. That's a partial rewriting. It's much more fun to look at where we use this. Let me start with horizontal partitioning. You saw how tough it was to express that as views, as virtual views. It turns out to be much easier to express horizontal partitioning if we express the view in the other direction. So instead of expressing customers as a big union, let's describe the base tables as projections from customer. So now we essentially tell the system that we have these materialized views: customers in Houston, customers in Seattle, customers in Canada, and now we have a query which says, give me, it's a query of a customer. The system's job is, can it use these materialized views sitting around and answer this query by using the materialized views? It's an application of query writing using views. I still need 5 minutes. Is it okay if we continue to discuss 5 minutes? The second is aggressive use of indexes. It's something that database systems do right now. What is an index? Here we have a big table called product. What is an index on weight? It's a B+ tree where we have all the weights, which are just serial numbers. And next to they are organized in a big B+ tree. And next to the weights, we have what?
Pointer to the
records. And actually, in many systems, these pointers are exactly the primary key. So you can think of the weights index as being a file that consists of pairs of weights and PID. There is a separate index on price that is a file of prices and PIDs. Now let's look at this query here. It says go to product and select all the weights and prices where the weight is greater than 10 and the price is less than 100. If you run this in SQL Server, and if your data is indeed big, if the product is big, which files do you think will SQL Server access? It's quite smart, actually. Just the indexes. This is what they call an optimization, aggressive use of indexes. How can the system figure out? Well, indexes are views. Here is how to think about W, the weight index. It's just the set of PID weight pairs. It has a special physical organization, but in terms of data that it contains, it's just a set of these pairs. Similarly, the P index is a set of PID weight, one of them is price pairs. And now we have a query writing using views problem. Here is a query. Here are the two views. Can you rewrite the query in terms of the views? So aggressive use of indexes is an instance of query rewriting using views. The third one is something that was studied in the 80s. I'm not sure how much systems have actually picked up, but the idea is very simple and very generous. Database systems evaluate queries all the time. And of course, they have a cache. They have the buffer pool cache, but that's a physical cache. In addition to the physical cache, you can imagine a logical cache in which you just store all the queries answered that you can afford to store in main memory. So as you answer queries, you store them in main memory. When a new query comes along, the question to ask is, since you have these queries in main memory, maybe you can exploit them. Maybe you can use these queries to answer your new query. Then you don't need to go to the database. This is called semantic caching. And to decide whether you can use these queries or not, you need to do query rewriting using views. And that's it, I think. Yep. So to summarize, views, the simple views are just the virtual views that we have discussed at the beginning. That's what database systems use most of the time. But the concept of view goes beyond that. It can be used in a virtual way or in a materialized way, and there are so many interesting both applications and techniques that can be developed in the context of use. Good. So, sorry for running over. Please feel free to continue to ask me questions by email. Maybe not as many questions as we got recently, especially Ming. And I'll see you next week. Good luck with your homework.